And Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, this is your impregnably genial host, John Derbyshire, with the news of the hour. The news is pretty much all domestic this week. Foreigners have been falling down on their natural responsibility to keep us either amused or annoyed. So we're letting down our bucket this week into the well of US politics. The water's kind of murky, but if you put it under the microscope, there's some interesting and colourful wildlife in there. We had a Republican primary election in Florida, a big and electorally important state with 27 electoral college votes. And that's precisely 10% of the 270 that you need to win the presidency. Of Florida's 4 million registered Republicans, 41% came out to vote. Nearly half of them chose Mitt Romney, with the rest dividing up their votes among other candidates. Newt Gingrich did respectably well, coming second with 32% of the vote. Enough to keep the flame of hope still burning in Newt's bosom, though not enough to get him any convention delegates, as Florida's primary is winner-take-all. That 32% is, though, more than 500,000 souls. Enough for quite a substantial lunar colony, so I guess Newt can take comfort in that. Romney now looks strong for the nomination. I'll just remind him and his team of the old English saying that there's many a slip twixt cup and lip. It's 207 days to the convention, which will also be in Florida, and that's plenty of time for scandals to emerge, lethal gaffes to be committed, and for the fickle finger of fate to give Mitt a poke in the eye. Right now, though, the odds strongly favour him. The conservative Republicans that I know all acknowledge this, with various degrees of sullen resignation, but with none of the kind of black despair that Bob Dole and John McCain inspired. Romney is not a congressional lifer like Dole, mumbling incoherently about cloture and supplementals. Nor is he a foam-flecked romantic crusader like McCain, lusting to send off expeditionary forces hither and yon, financed by borrowed money. For all our doubts and hesitations about Romney, let's try to look on the bright side. He at least understands that ends need to bear some relation to means. He at least has been chief executive of a state, haggling with legislators. He may have changed his position on this or that, but at least he's not shown a willingness to say absolutely anything, like Newt Gingrich, who was his principal adversary in Florida. I have my doubts about Mitt, but at last, like other conservative Republicans, I'm going to be saying what mothers say when their 30-something daughters announce that they have finally talked a man into meeting them at the altar. He'll do. As I said, there's plenty of time for lethal gaffes. Mitt Romney gaffed this week. If gaff may be used as a verb, which I hereby declare it may. I don't think this one was lethal, but it stirred up the media and gave Newt Gingrich an opportunity to say something silly. Not that Newt needs much inciting. In an interview with limousine liberal Soledad O'Brien of CNN, Mitt Romney passed the following remarks.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90-95% of Americans who right now are struggling.
O'Brien jumped right on that.
You just said, I'm not concerned about the very poor because they have a safety net. And I think there are lots of very poor Americans who are struggling who would say, that sounds odd.
You could see Willard thinking to himself, whoops, darn it. Now, of course, the thing Mitt said, taken in its entirety, is sensible and reasonable. Running for political office does require a candidate to say sensible and reasonable things. However, it also requires the candidate to say those things in sentences that cannot be chopped up into six-word fragments to be fired back at him from his enemy's potato guns. Mitt, of course, knows this, and he must have realised immediately that he'd made a gaffe. He probably also knows that you don't get through a months-long campaign, speaking on the fly a lot of the time, without occasionally committing some blooper like this. So I'd guess he's fairly philosophical about it. Let me tell you, as a writer turning out around 10,000 words a month, I probably utter six-word fragments as usable, I mean, as usable by a political enemy, as Romney's, pretty much hourly. Fortunately, I'm not trying to get elected to any public office. Being a political candidate is somewhat like running through a rainstorm trying to dodge between the drops. This particular gaffe would be utterly trivial, in fact, but for two magnifying factors. Magnifying factor one, Romney is rich. Not as rich as John Kerry or Al Gore, nothing like as rich as the Clintons, but quite likely richer than Nancy Pelosi, richer than Barack Obama was in 2008. I guess maybe richer than Soledad O'Brien, who is a millionaireess in her own right married to an investment banker. The second magnifying factor, Romney's a Republican, so not only will his political enemies use this as ammunition, the media will help those enemies all they can. If Romney were a Democrat, the media folk would already be out there with brooms sweeping it under the carpet. Newt Gingrich was right behind Ms. O'Brien, offering us this little nugget of Gingrichiana. Quote, "I really believe that we should care about the very poor, unlike Governor Romney. But I believe we should care differently than Barack Obama." Both Governor Romney and Barack Obama seem to believe that a, quote, safety net is all the poor need. I don't believe that. What the poor need is a trampoline so that they can spring up. So I'm for replacing the safety net with a trampoline, end quote. Typical Newt. Colourful and imaginative use of words, but totally without any meaning. I'm not even sure I know who the poor are anymore. There's a neighbourhood near me that everyone calls poor, but the inhabitants all seem to have $100 sneakers and blackberries. I guess that the main drivers of poverty in the USA today are 1. Single motherhood, 2. Floods of illegal immigrants depressing the wages of the unskilled, 3. Easy availability of welfare, and 4. The outsourcing of manufacturing jobs. That's a behavioural problem, a law enforcement problem, a social problem, and an economic problem. I don't know that a trampoline can encompass all those problem areas. But perhaps a bouncy castle might. There was a dog that did not bark in the Florida result. That was the Hispanic voters of the state turning against Mitt Romney for his firm words on illegal immigration. Everyone had said they would, but they didn't. In fact, not only did they didn't, but Latino voters in Florida went for Romney over Gingrich in higher proportions than Republicans overall. The overall percentages were 46 Romney to 32 Gingrich. Among Hispanics, they were 54 Romney, 29 Gingrich. A big factor there was that Florida Hispanics are mainly of Cuban and Puerto Rican origin. The actual percentages for Florida Hispanics from the Pew Research Center are Cuban origin 32%, Puerto Rican origin 28%, Mexican 9%. The Cubans are refugees from a socialist dictatorship, or the children or grandchildren of such. So they are naturally allergic to leftism. And they probably, and quite correctly, perceive amnesty programs like Gingrich's as leftist-inspired. The Puerto Ricans are citizens who never have to think about immigration and who regard Mexicans as foreign competition in the labour market. Bottom line, Florida Hispanics don't care much about immigration. For those registered as Republicans, that must be doubly true. The joke here is the cluelessness of elite white commentariat and political types, folk like Newt Gingrich, who think that Hispanics are a single herd that can be corralled this way or that. Hey, that looks like a Hispanic voter. Quick, give me my immigration flashcards. Professional Hispanics, like Congressman Luis Gutierrez or commentator Geraldo Rivera, encourage this illusion, and lazy-minded polls, like Gingrich, fall for it. Having said that, Florida Hispanics are somewhat atypical, and in campaigning elsewhere, Mitt Romney will be up against much more solid blocks of Mexican origin and Central American origin voters, to whom the immigration issue is more salient. But having said that, the whole issue of the Hispanic vote is inflated by the race lobbyists. And again, sloppy and ignorant polls like Newt Gingrich fall for the scam. In the 2008 presidential election, when minorities were exceptionally fired up by Barack Obama's candidacy, the Hispanic share of the vote was 7.4%. The non-Hispanic white share was 76.3%, more than 10 times the Hispanic share. Put it another way, if a candidate has only so much time and effort to put into winning votes, one non-Hispanic white vote is worth more than 10 times one Hispanic vote. If you're a Republican politician, the relative worth of white and Hispanic votes is even greater, since Hispanics in the generality, with, for example, an over 50% illegitimacy rate and near 20% high school dropout rate, Hispanics are more welfare dependent than whites, and so are more locked into the Democratic Party. There are local considerations that skew the picture, but overall, so far as a Republican presidential candidate is concerned, the non-Hispanic white vote is a 10-course banquet, while the Hispanic vote is a bag of nacho chips. But having said that, as a swelling cohort of Hispanic citizens moves up through the school system and into adulthood, that 7% will become 10, then 20, then 30%, and by mid-century will be challenging the non-Hispanic white vote for demographic supremacy. By that time, however, the nation will be so tribalized and ethnic disaggregation will be so advanced, the USA will no longer have any real identity, and it will probably have broken up, like Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia or Cyprus. Well, sufficient unto the day the evil thereof. Let's concentrate on this electoral cycle, for which a key point Mitt Romney needs to remember is that Hispanic electoral influence, its size and its coherence, is hugely exaggerated by Democratic race activists for strategic purposes. In most parts of the country, for a Republican candidate, the Hispanic vote is a bagatelle, and the black vote is, of course, solid for Obama. It's the white vote Romney needs to win. For that purpose, polite but firm talk about honouring and enforcing the people's laws on immigration is the way to go. The nation was on tenterhooks all day Thursday, waiting for Donald Trump to say something or other. what it was we were waiting for him to say, and what he eventually said, and what tenterhooks actually are all things that I may have known at one point, but have since forgotten. Okay, hands up, those listeners who disagree with the following statement. Barack Obama is a typical early 21st century leftist yuppie agnostic who goes from one year's end to the next without having a religious thought, and whose 20 years of attendance at Trinity United Church of Christ...
Now God bless America! God damn America!
...was motivated entirely by his need for networking in the black Chicago political establishment. Hands up if you disagree with that. Hands up? Anyone? Anyone? Nobody? Yeah, that's what I thought. Now look, I have no window into men's souls. You won't find anyone more willing than I am to give a guy a pass on his notions about the supernatural. Mitt Romney, for example, presumably believes all the Angel Moroni stuff. The golden tablets, the magic spectacles, the Cherokees are Jewish, the whole nine yards. Well, jolly good luck to him. I do, though, like everyone else in the world, I do try to form some working estimate of what a person believes by observing his behaviour. On that basis, I have great difficulty understanding how a person who for 20 years, 20 blessed years, listeners, sat and listened uncomplainingly to the white-hating, anti-Semitic sermons of Jeremiah Wright, I have problems understanding how such a person can be a faithful disciple of the Prince of Peace. Just 4 years ago, on his 2007 tax returns, Obama logged a $27,000 donation to Wright's church. That's just 4 years ago. Wright's sermons were themselves inspired, according to Wright's own account, by the teachings of black liberation theologian James Cone. Sample quote from him, quote, "Black theology will accept only the love of God which participates in the destruction of the white enemy," end quote. You don't need a window into men's souls to think that anyone who sits quietly listening to stuff like that for 1,000 Sabbaths is either A, just as deranged by pathological loathing of the white man as Wright and Cone are, or B, fathomlessly cynical. In the case of Barack Obama, I go with B. It was therefore mildly nauseating to see Obama at a national prayer breakfast telling the attendees that
we can all benefit from turning to our Creator, listening to Him, avoiding phony religiosity.
Yeah, heaven forbid we should fall into phony religiosity. The president then went off into a ramble through the social gospel, arguing that Jesus of Nazareth, along with Moses, Muhammad, the Buddha, Zoroaster, and whoever it was who wrote the Bhagavad Gita, all want us to increase student loans, offer mortgage relief, send more taxpayer money to barbarian dictators as so-called foreign aid, and open up the nation's borders to more future Democrat voters. Oh, I'm sorry, I mean undocumented workers. The great religious teachers wanted us, in other words, to create a kingdom of heaven on earth, according to Obama. I can't speak to Zoroaster and the Bhagavad Gita author, with neither of whom I have any acquaintance, but my rather strong impression of the others is that a kingdom of heaven on earth is the exact opposite of what they sought. I am, however, no theologian, so you should form your own judgment here. The whole emetic speech was seasoned with professions of patriotism.
that as a country we rise and fall together.
A bit hard to square with Jeremiah Wright's best-known remark. With bogus humility.
I must try, imperfectly, but I must try.
And with apt scriptural quotations.
John tells us that if anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth.
What kinds of actions would St. John like us to perform as testimony to our love of God? Well,
making sure insurance companies aren't discriminating against those who are already sick.
I don't quite get that, Mr. President. If insurance companies may not discriminate between those who have not yet encountered the eventuality being insured against and those who have, how is it insurance? Does St. John cover this point somewhere in his gospel? Please instruct me. Is there any relevance to November's election here? Probably not, although it does say in the good book that the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment, which I take to be encouraging. A couple of stories here from the Academy. I'll pack them together in one segment. First, there's the scandal at Claremont McKenna College in Southern California. An expensive and highly ranked liberal arts school with 1,300 undergraduates. College President Pamela Gann announced this week that the college admissions department had been gaming the US News and World Report rankings for the past 7 years by falsifying the SAT scores of admitted students. Richard Voss, who's been Dean of Admissions at the college since 1987, resigned in disgrace on Monday. Why would an admissions officer at a high-priced, very selective college need to inflate incoming SAT scores? Affirmative action, that's why. Claremont was caught in a bind. On the one hand, they had to keep their position on the US News and World Report list, which is the nation's gold standard for college rankings, and the first thing parents go to when selecting colleges. On the other hand, Claremont McKenna had made a strategic decision to improve campus diversity by accepting inner-city minority students with substandard SAT scores. The only way to square the circle was to cheat and lie, so that's what Claremont McKenna did. You can read the whole sordid story at Andrew Breitbart's biggovernment.com, where Charles Johnson, a past editor of the Claremont McKenna Conservative Student newspaper, has dug out the facts. It illustrates yet again the deeply corrupting and dishonest nature of the whole diversity racket. Claremont McKenna's college motto is Crescit cum commercio civitas. Civilization prospers with commerce. When false doctrines take over the minds of those in charge of key civilizational institutions, like universities, civilization does not prosper. It rots. Second story. Nearby Pomona College, also in Claremont, California, got itself into the New York Times by asking college workers to show proof that they were not working in the country illegally. 17 workers who couldn't do so were fired. The Times story is naturally pro-scofflaw, with much lachrymose testimony from the laid-off illegals. Sample quote, "We were here for a very long time and there was never a complaint," said Christian Torres, 25, a cook who had worked at the college for 6 years. "But now, all of the sudden, we were suspect, and they didn't want us to work here anymore." End quote. Well, yes, because the college authorities don't want to be in violation of immigration law. Duh. Another sample quote, this one from 30-year-old Carmen, who'd been working at the college for $17 an hour. Quote, I really don't know what I'm going to do, she said, adding that her options were to look for work that paid in cash or move back to Mexico with her 2-year-old son while her husband, an American citizen, stayed here. End quote. Yo, Carmen, if your husband is a citizen, he can petition for a green card for you. You'll probably have to go back to Mexico for a while to regularize your situation, but that's the kind of inconvenience that comes upon you when you ignore the laws of a foreign country. Alternatively, you and your husband could relocate to Mexico, which is a pretty nice country, just not as nice as the USA. Alternatively, again, you could migrate to a really poor country like Ethiopia or Laos. Then you'd realize how lucky you are to have been born Mexican. The really heartening thing about this New York Times story is the comment thread, which is almost uniformly unsympathetic to the scoff laws. Several commenters noted that $17 an hour would be a pretty good wage for any student who wanted to work his way through college, as used to be common. Even New York Times readers, apparently, are getting fed up with illegal immigration. Something happened in Syria again, and something else happened in Egypt. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item, next year, New York City will pass an interesting milestone. The cost of benefits for the 4 uniformed services, that's police, fire, prisons and sanitation, will exceed the cost of salaries for those services. The long-term trend is for continued relentless divergence, the gap widening each year. Also rising are debt service costs for the city. Here you have a paradigm for the nation at large, indeed for most of the developed world. The art of managing public finances in the years to come will be an ever more desperate struggle to cover debt service and Giza maintenance expenses with tax revenues from a dwindling pool of productive workers. As always, New York leads the way. Item. An Afghan soldier, that is a member of the army we've been supplying and training this past 10 years. You're welcome. An Afghan soldier shot and killed a NATO serviceman, nationality not revealed, on Tuesday. This is barely newsworthy. Afghan soldiers shoot NATO soldiers at a steady rate. There were 17 incidents last year, up from 6 the year before. Our loyal Afghan allies started off the tally this year by shooting dead 4 French soldiers in mid-January, all in one batch. Meanwhile, a leaked report on interrogations by the US military showed widespread and growing support for the Taliban, even within the so-called Afghan government. It is now perfectly clear that when NATO forces leave Afghanistan, the Taliban will take over at once, with strong public support. So, all those years, 1,900 young American lives, untold hundreds of billions of dollars, were for what? Any chance we might airdrop a few dozen members of Congress, along with key members of the Bush and Obama administrations, into the Hindu Kush? Parachutes optional, far as I'm concerned. Item, Facebook's initial public offering is in the news. The actual offering is some weeks away yet, but Facebook filed on Wednesday with the SEC and it's got everyone talking. I'll confess to mixed feelings here, both positive and negative. Positive. It's great to know that capitalism still works, that smart college kids can get rich from building a better mousetrap. I especially like the story of the guy who did a paint job on Facebook's building and took his payment in shares instead of cash. He'll never have to work again. Negative. Well, naturally, envy at all the fortunes being made. Also, incomprehension about the product itself. Three different friends have all tried to get me interested in Facebook, and all have failed. It just seems shallow and pointless. Really, just a vehicle for advertising. If you were to ask me to make a list of things I would rather spend half an hour doing than being logged into Facebook, that would be a mighty long list. I think a Facebook session might rank just ahead of clipping my toenails, but that's roughly where the crossover point is. If Facebook is a better mousetrap, what is the mouse? I just don't get it. Oh, and just a word for all you investors reaching for your wallets. MySpace. That's it, folks. Way over time again, and the suits are making frantic gestures at me through the producer's glass wall. Hey, that's one I haven't seen before. Is that really physically possible, though, without someone holding the other arm? Interesting. Okay, gotta go.